It's Wednesday, the 11th of June, 2025, and this is Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast with David Taylor and Phil Bishop, nattering about some of the construction industry news that's caught our attention over the past fortnight. How are you doing there, Phil?
I'm all right. I'm waiting for the sun to come out. I've dressed for summer and it hasn't happened quite yet, but it's going to happen this afternoon, so all good. I'm also very excited. We are talking, David, before what may or may not be a big government announcement, Rachel Reeves spending review. And sometimes when we plot what we're going to talk about, we think, oh, you know, there's a budget this afternoon. Maybe we should hold back and not you know, have our podcast until we've not recorded this and meet until we know what she's going to say. Well, we kind of already know what she's going to say, and I'm not terribly excited about it because it's more hype than substance, I'm afraid. There's a great piece I can refer you to by the Sunday Times economic editor or whatever. Is that his name? David Smith. It's in the Times this morning. Economics editor of the Sunday Times. It's in the Daily Times this morning. Basically exposing the smoke and mirrors and the dark arts of how you know, chancellors over the years re-announce and rehash things and add up numbers several times and the same numbers, and they blur things between percent and percentage points and whatever. And so, all this stuff that is the Chancellor wants to be very excited about this afternoon, don't be, no need.
I get the feeling, maybe it's just a perception and it's not the reality, but I get the feeling that Rachel Reeves is always standing up and making important announcements. I mean, back in the olden days, I'm sure that there used to be one budget a year. The Chancellor would stand up with a glass of whiskey and chunter on for a whole morning, and then that would be it for another year.
There
came the autumn statement, and then there various other sort of intermediate announcements, and now she seems to be doing it almost weekly.
Yes, I think the autumn statements have been around for a long time. The what used to be the spring budget, as I said before, is about how we're going to take money off you. And then the autumn statement was, which has now become flipped, but the second statement of the year 6 months later was how we're going to spend the money we've taken off you. But she did that spending statement, whatever it was, a couple of months ago. And now there's another one following a review. And it's going to be, we're going to spend, you know, masses on social housing and masses on infrastructure. And what I'd like to talk about first is among these big infrastructure projects, which they announced sort of ahead of the spending review on Tuesday this week. So we're talking on Wednesday yesterday for us.
Yeah.
That Sizewell C is going ahead. It's going ahead. We're announcing it's happening. We're going to create thousands of jobs. We're piling on, you know, green light for Sizewell C. And even the Financial Times, somewhat surprisingly, sort of talks about the UK has ended years of uncertainty over the future of its nuclear industry, it says, by pledging £11.5 billion of new state funding for Sizewell C. I'm a bit confused why they say 11.5. The government's saying 14.2. And so I don't know what the real number is or how, you know, what's being added up to what. But the point I want to make is that just as we had the same conversation about the Lower Thames Crossing a few weeks ago in this podcast, the government want you to think we've given it the green light, it's going ahead, but neither of these projects are going ahead because there's no money for them.
No,
I mean, yes, there's 11.5 billion, 14 billion, or maybe after what's gone before, nearly 18 billion of government money gone into it, but this thing's going to cost 40 billion. And I don't even know whether we're talking about 2018 or 2026 numbers, or who's, you know, what year's money that is. That's the other caveat to chuck in on these things. They're going to need another 20 billion at least to find from private investors, just like they said, we're going ahead with the Lower Thames Crossing, but first of all, we've got to find some money from somewhere.
Yeah.
So it's just another green light. I mean, Sizewell C has been given loads of green lights, and here's another one. And it's great. I'd much rather they say what they're saying than say we decide to scrap it like they did with Stonehenge Tunnel Scheme. We need it, clearly, the Sizewell C, or at least we need another nuclear power station. You can argue what technology it should be and where it should be built, but we're a long way down the road with Sizewell C. So my sympathies to the good burghers of Suffolk, but It's going to happen, but I'm not sure that you and I will still be alive to see it come on stream, David.
That's quite likely. Yeah. I mean, I, as you say, it's one of these things where, I mean, we've been talking about Sizewell C almost as long as we've been talking about Hinkley Point C. It's always been on the cards and it always looks as if it was going to happen. It's just a matter of sort of shuffling the papers on the desk and you know, signing another piece of paper and getting it, edging a little bit closer. Yeah, I know that these projects can always be cancelled at last minute. You mentioned the Stonehenge Tunnel, and I suppose Sizewell C was a possible candidate for that sort of treatment. But things have obviously been going very much in the direction of nuclear power recently, and I find the sight of Ed Miliband talking about a golden age of nuclear seems really, really odd, because when I was growing up, everybody in the Labour Party was... Well, not everybody in the Labour Party. When I was really tiny, it was a white heat of technology, wasn't it? And Harold Wilson. But, I mean, no, it seems that people on the left certainly seemed very anti-nuclear back in the 80s.
In the 80s, everyone apart from Jack Cunningham, who was the MP for Sellafield, and Lord Harry of Troon, who was a Labour peer who would write weekly in New Civil Engineer saying how we need more nuclear. But on the whole, you're right, that we associated the Labour Party as being absolutely anti-nuclear, not just ban the bomb, but anti-nuclear power.
Yeah. A lot of people were, I mean, back in the 80s. But back then, I suppose, you know, that we were worried about things like, well, there had been Three Mile Island, and then, of course, there was Chernobyl, and more recently, the Fukushima plant, which blew up. But that was an earthquake that did that. I mean... Yeah, it's when nuclear goes wrong, it's really scary, and it has a lot of repercussions, of course. And you can understand why people are scared of it, because after all, it's the same technology that blew up Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So
it's not just that; it's what you do with the waste. It's half a million years of radioactive waste that you've got to bury somewhere.
You've got to bury it very deep in the ground and out of sight, out of mind. I don't know, but now it's green energy, though. I mean, forget about the waste. Nobody's talking about the waste, Phil. It's green energy because it's not fossil fuel. And so that's why Ed Miliband's all for it. And the other thing which he's given the green... Well, Angela Rayner, I think, has given the green light to, is this idea of small modular nuclear reactors. So these are much smaller power stations, located strategically near where the energy is required. Because again, this is another completely different issue. Generating the energy is one thing. Actually delivering it to where it's needed is quite another. And that's a whole different but related kettle of fish. But yeah, small nuclear reactors, small modular nuclear reactors, which I think are quite a good idea. I like the idea of a small nuclear power station tucked away somewhere, you know, down a side street, powering a town and, you know, giving everybody clean, free, well, not free, but cheap energy.
My impression is a bit like having a nuclear submarine parked around the corner.
Well, this is it, yeah. I mean, I think actually they're a lot bigger than nuclear submarines, but that's basically it. A nuclear submarine has got a small modular nuclear reactor inside it. And, you know, there are a few hundred blokes underneath the ice cap with a nuclear reactor. They don't seem to be particularly worried about it. But I suppose people have resisted the idea of these things largely because of the fact that when it comes to nuclear power, everybody's a NIMBY and nobody wants a small modular reactor down the end of their street, you know, getting ready to blow up like Chernobyl or something like that.
Well, no one's anything down the end of their street. No one.
Well, that's true.
Turbines or anything.
except a Waitrose, maybe.
But it's interesting. I listened to a short bit by my favourite journalist, Ros Atkins, at the BBC. He does all the explaining things, idiot guide things. And it does seem to make complicated things very clear. And it's talking about, in the context of where our electricity comes from in the UK, it had a little table showing, a chart showing that in 1980... 85% of our electricity came from fossil fuels. 2023, that had gone down to 35%, and that's because of all the net zero imperative. Over the same timeline, renewables had gone from about 1.5% to about 44%. Massive rise in that. Nuclear had basically stood still, 13.8% in 1980, 13.2% in 2023. No new nuclear has come on the stream, and several things have been turned off, and more nuclear power stations are going to be turned off. And we're not going to get Sizewell C. The first unit is not going to come on stream for another 6-7 years or something. And I don't know how many years after that the second reactor will come on stream. I mean, it's supposed to be coming on stream this year, was the original plan. When they started construction in 2017, 2018, it's supposed to be sparking up this year.
Sizewell or Hinkley Point?
This is Hinkley Point, I beg your pardon. Did I say Sizewell?
You said Hinkley Sizewell. Point.
Of course I did. I apologise. So that's Hinkley Point. So Sizewell, they're not going to start. Okay, they've shifted a lot of earth and they've done a lot of the prep work in Sizewell ahead of things, but they're not really going to start building in anger for another year or two at best. And it's probably going to be 20 years before that comes on stream. Mm. You know, we're looking towards 2050 before.
They're absolutely adamant it's going to be a decade. So 2035 is when it's going to happen, apparently. But the argument is, of course, and this is a logical argument that this is an exact replica of Hinkley Point C. So having done all the learning on Hinkley Point C, things will be a lot more certain. We'll know exactly. In fact, I heard somebody on the radio yesterday saying we'll know exactly how much concrete we need, exactly how much steel we need, and exactly how much time we need to design and build these, because we've already done it at Hinkley Point. And this person's pointed out that the second unit at Hinkley Point, because of course we've got two new reactors going in there. The first one is ahead of the second one, and the second one is 25% faster in delivery because they've learned on the first one. So maybe it will be quicker, and hopefully it will be cheaper. Whether or not it will be substantially cheaper, I don't know.
But weren't they supposed to have taken learning from the European pressurised reactor design, so using it at both Hinkley Point and C and Sizewell C?
Yeah.
That was taken from Fehmarnville, and I think there's one in Scandinavia, one somewhere else, and they've all been hugely late and slow. They don't seem that good at learning. I mean, okay, maybe they're doing the second one at Hinkley Point quicker because they're in the same place.
Same team, people, so. In the same place, yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's a woman called Alison Downs who's a spokesperson for the Stop Sizewell C campaign. And she pointed out exactly what you've just said, that all EPR builds in China, Finland, France, and the UK, so she's talking about Hinkley Point, have cost billions more than predicted and have been between 5 and 14 years late. So, yeah, I mean, that learning curve hasn't worked there. Maybe it will be different if they're taking the same people and the same same organisations, not necessarily the same individuals, then maybe the learnings will be carried over from Hinkley Point to Sizewell C. But only time will tell, and it'll take a lot of time one way or the other.
You're probably more tuned into these things than I am, but we've learned from things like Crossrail, for example, railway projects, how the actual civil engineering bit, digging the tunnel and lining it with concrete, is the easy bit. And when it comes to actually putting in a high-tech computerized train set, that's when it really gets complicated and unforeseen things happen. I mean, unforeseen things can happen in tunneling as well, but we're experienced at that. But Crossrail's delays, Elizabeth Line as it now is, were very much to do with the railway bit of it rather than the digging bit of it. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Is the same true of nuclear power stations? Are we going to find that, I mean, yes, we're about 5-6 years late on the building of the thing, but when we get towards the back end of it, the actual nuclear end of things.
What, wiring it up?
Yeah, is it going to be like Crossrail? Are we going to think we're then going to see real, even more delays?
Well,
I don't know.
I mean, logic would seem to suggest to me that yes, it's exactly the same sort of situation, because the I think that tunneling isn't all that straightforward actually, because apart from anything else, you've got variable ground conditions and lots of unknown obstacles that can pop up. I would have thought that actually the electronic bit, the services, would be easier, because once you've got your infrastructure, your physical infrastructure, surely you can design your wiring diagrams and your computer programs and goodness knows what else it takes to run the thing. I would have thought that would be relatively easy. Clearly it's not. And on that understanding, I guess that, yeah, the same thing must apply to nuclear power stations as apply to a metro system, that, you know, there must be some incredibly complicated electronics and management systems going into running a nuclear power station. So maybe we'll find out when they come to the commissioning stage of the whole project that haven't connected the positive to the positive, and somebody's got their resistors the wrong way around or something like that.
Yes, well, they need to get on. I mean, get on and build Sizewell C with, apologies to Alison Downs and the opponents of the scheme. Mm. If I lived there, I'd be opposing it too, I'm quite sure. But it's one of these things where...
There's already a nuclear power station there. I mean, it's not like they're building a brand new nuclear power station on a greenfield site. I don't know how intrusive it would be for...
I think it's a construction of it. It's going to be the lorry movement.
Yeah,
it's 20 years of massive construction and lorry movements, all this stuff going on.
Yes, it's probably that. But anyway, yeah, I think it has to go on. Especially, I mean, we're not going to hit the 2050 net zero target anyway, but let's at least try.
Well, the target is 25% nuclear by 2050. And the other point I should mention that Ros Atkins was talking about was it's not just the net zero imperative as to why we've gone, the big renewables kick was mm-hmm. for net zero. The other thing that's happened since Putin invaded Ukraine is it's all about energy security. Yeah. We were relying on this pipeline to get gas from Russia. Was it gas or oil? Gas, wasn't it? Mm. And now we think, we can't rely on that. So we've got to be self-sufficient. And if we have nuclear fuel, the theory is, although I don't quite know where the uranium comes from. I don't think that comes from Cornwall, does it?
I don't think so.
Our next topic, we're going to stay on the subject of energy. Our next topic, so I want to come back to this about the idea that we need resilience and homegrown energy rather than importing stuff. But the idea is that if we get our nuclear power stations built, 25% of our energy supply, electricity supply, comes from nuclear by 2050, it will give us a degree of resilience against international events.
Yeah, which is probably true. And that's definitely the message that Mr. Miliband is promoting as well. I mean, he's made that point in several interviews I've seen with him, that, you know, we need to become self-sufficient in energy and, this is a new world order and all the rest of it. So, yeah, it's true. That's obviously true. It's also a big justification for more renewables as well. You alluded to our next topic. We might as well move on to that, which is this new mandate that the government wants to make sure that as many new homes as possible have solar panels on the roof. It's part of the Future Homes Standard.
That's it. The Future Homes Standard, which has been knocking around for ages. I mean, it's typically a new government comes in and says, look what we're doing. Well, this is continuation of as with Sizewell, as with most of the things that the Labour government has been doing for the past year. That it's the continuation and embracing what's gone before. Future Homes Standard, I don't think when it comes out, it'll be very different from what the Tories had intended it to be. And, yeah, there's going to be a requirement for, wherever practicable, new homes will have to have solar panels, which sounds perfectly sensible. What's your view?
Yeah, obviously not every single new house will have solar panels on the roof, because I'm sure that lots of bespoke homes built for millionaires will have nice... mellow terracotta tiles on the roof, and they won't want those spoiled with horrible glass sheets of solar panels. But yeah, I mean, I can't see that it's going to cause any problems for anybody, actually, if every new house, Barrett home or Persimmon home, has one side of its roof covered with solar panels. I think it's fair enough. And you know, I'd much rather they did that than cover you know, prime agricultural land with acres and acres of solar panels, which of course have happened around where I live and they're happening all over the country, and upsetting a lot of people in the process. No, I think putting them on top of new homes is a good idea, generally speaking.
Well, I have a slightly different view, and I'll come on to what I think in a minute. But I think it's first of all worth saying that, by and large, the consensus is exactly what you say. I mean, why not? If you're going to save 500 quid a year or whatever it is on your energy bills,
that's what they say.
With a few solar panels, no brainer, do it. One or two people are saying, yeah, it's not quite that straightforward. We had a very good response from the National Federation of Builders saying that there are things we need to overcome. There are hiccups on the way, that we, wrinkles we need to iron out. One of those is the connections. You know, the grid connections is a bit of a logjam. The other thing is that there will be supply chain delays, and that if having, you know, all these electric buildings, we might not be able to move as quickly as the government wants, and there might be delays to the you know, higher build costs, longer planning delays, and that will mean, you know, builders going out of business while things are delayed, and so it's not going to be a smooth ride. That's what they say, which I think is interesting. I would make two other points. First is just to say that solar isn't quite as green and cuddly and lovely as we might immediately assume. These solar panels, I think they're all made in, well, at least half of them are made in China, if not more than that. So we're hardly making our energy supply self-sufficient if we're relying on Chinese products. There's high electricity usage and CO2 emissions in the manufacture of them, chemical intensive, you know, contaminating soil and water with these chemicals. The life expectancy of solar panels is pretty short. Okay, it's more than your gas boiler, but it's, you know, 25 years of your solar panel. And they reckon that by 2050 there'll be 10 million tonnes of solar panel waste, and they're not being recycled, hardly any recycling of these things. So it's not as green as you think. And the whole idea of you know, sun shining down, converting it into electricity is great. But it may not be the best solution, which brings me on to my second point, which I would be much happier if the government was to say, we ban the use of fossil fuel-derived energy in all new build homes by whatever year they care to mention. We're going to outlaw that. And leave it to the market, leave it to the builders, leave it to the developments, leave it to homeowners, home buyers, to say what solution, alternative solution, what clean solution they prefer to use. And now, I think it's pigging obvious that in the immediate term, that will be a combination of heat pumps and solar power, because that is what we have, the solution we have now. But I don't think it should be for the government to say, this is the solution you must choose, just because they haven't got the imagination or the knowledge to know that there might be some other solution just around the corner. And it's a bit like, you can imagine the government saying in 2015 that every council home has got to have a DVD player in it because it's unfair that they haven't got a DVD player. You know, everyone who's got their own home has got a DVD player, therefore the poor should have it. And it's a bit like, you know, a human right, like internet connection. You've got to have a DVD player. And if they said in 2015 everyone's got to have a DVD player, people might have thought, oh, what a lovely government. They're giving us this nice toy to play with, so we're not going to be bored at home. We can watch all our DVDs. And of course, within 12 months, DVDs are paperweights because streaming has become mainstream. But the government didn't know. They couldn't predict that. They're behind. Governments and regulators are always behind the curve on anything to do with technology. Now, maybe solar power is absolutely the answer in 2025, 2026, and maybe even 2027. But they've ruled out hydrogen, but hydrogen might make a comeback, or there might be some completely other thing that Elon Musk is going to bring to us in about 15 minutes' time. which will be, you know, maybe the whole business of us eating our dinner and flushing it away the following morning down to sewage works and processing, maybe will be some magic new device where we can have our own little mini sewage works at the outside of our house, which will turn all that to electricity. Yeah. I don't know whether that's feasible or not, but that, you know, so it would be absolutely virtual circle within the own human body. Our own body will be powering the house by our human waste.
I mean, I think you make a good. Who knows? I think you make a good point, though, that it's better to actually create the incentive rather than prescribe a solution.
Exactly, yes. Say what you don't want, but don't tell people how to sell. Don't mandate how the problem should be solved.
The previous government came close to doing that when they said that no more new gas boilers in homes after, was it 2030? That, you know, you've got to find an alternative to your gas boiler for all new homes in 2030. So in that case, they were putting the ball back in the developer's court. I mean, everybody's now piled in and said, right, okay, then heat pumps. You know, heat pumps are the solution. Heat pumps might be the solution, but as you say, there might be other solutions around the corner, and people might be working on them already.
I think there are some builders out there who quite like the idea of government telling them, this is how you must solve this problem. Because they're desperately scared of putting in Betamax, to use another aged TV watching technology, Betamax, when everyone else is going VHS. And you go, oh no, we've backed the wrong horse. And if they're told what horse to back, it's kind of safety.
Yeah, everybody's
made
the same
a mistake because they're simply doing. But I don't think it's the job of government to say, you know, we're banning Betamax. I think let the market decide, and we'll get the best solutions.
But at the moment, solar does seem to be the sort of flavour of the month, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Because I have no problem with developers putting solar power. I think it's absolutely sensible, and they should be doing it. I just don't think the government should be saying you have to do it.
Mm. Yeah,
I think the customers should be saying you have to do it. We're not going to buy a house without solar panels on it. Fine,
yeah, that's fair enough. Which that neatly brings us on to our next subtopic, which is all about solar arrays as well. But this is something else, isn't it? Which is quite interesting. A Swiss telecoms provider called Luke TDC, which had a couple of very large, still got a couple of very large satellite dishes on its site, in the town of Luke, L-E-W-K.
They're talking about satellite dishes, and when I started reading this, I thought they were a little sort of Alan Sugar type Amstrad that you watch Sky TV on. No, these are huge telecoms receivers.
Yeah,
they look like
sort of radio telescopes, don't they? They're very, I don't know how big they are, but I'd say they're probably about 20 meters across, something like that.
Well, I'm looking at a photo of one with a couple of chaps laying panels in there, and they must be more
really
than that. They must be half a football pitch sized.
There is a video, actually. In fact, because you posted this picture, you posted this story already, and there's a it's in German, it's in Swiss German, but with subtitles. There's a video all about it, which is quite interesting. It does show you these big satellite dishes. Yeah, they're huge, and they're sort of built on a big frame, and I think that they're designed to follow the satellite around, so that rather like a radio telescope, they will actually move, you know, in order to keep aligned.
They can now follow the sun rather than follow the satellite.
They can follow the sun, and this is the idea, because what they've done is they've teamed up with an energy firm, and I won't try and pronounce the German name, but it's CKW for short. Them and a renewable energy specialist called Solar Edge have fitted solar panels to the inside, you know, the sort of curved bowl of the satellite dish. And so these satellite dishes now, instead of picking up radio signals from outer space, they're gathering solar energy from the sun throughout the day and sort of rotating as the sun passes overhead, following it so that they remain aligned all the time. Which, when I first read about this, I thought was a really neat idea, because, I mean, the alternative, I suppose, they obviously don't need these satellite dishes for their telecoms business anymore. But they... there's a cost of decommissioning them, and they're very big, and taking them apart and getting rid of them would cost money. But they could actually use them to generate solar energy, which I thought was great. But in fact, it sounds neat in principle, but there are actually some problems, because the fact is, of course, these satellite dishes, they're sort of parabolic curve, aren't they? They're not flat. And if you look at any...
They're like a wok.
They're like a wok, extremely large wok. But I mean, if you look at most solar panels, they're just flat, aren't they? They're completely flat. They're usually orient, you know, they're angled towards the sun to get the optimum amount of sunlight during the day. Obviously, if you line the inside of one of these big woks with solar panels, they're all going to be pointing in a slightly different direction. In fact, they're all going to be pointing towards the actual receiver, which is on a sort of a tripod in front of the, just like your satellite dish when everybody had satellite television. Parabolic thing focuses the signal onto a receiver, which is slightly in front of the bowl. So they're all basically orientated towards this receiver, which of course isn't receiving anything anymore. So one of the chaps who designed this did talk about it, and I'll quote him because it's quite interesting. He says, given the complex orientation and inclination of the solar panels on the satellite dishes, shadows and varied inclinations threaten to reduce the efficiency of the solar array. Traditional string solar inverters, I don't know what those are, but obviously everybody has them on their solar panels, traditional string solar inverters reduce the overall performance to match the weakest performing panel on the string, meaning that one shaded panel could reduce energy yield considerably. To address this, SolarEdge's innovative DC-optimized inverter solution was used with power optimizers attached to the underside. And basically, what they're saying, they use technology to overcome this problem. So it was not as easy as it at first appears, but they seem to have solved it.
You got me thinking, I should have, when I was using my DVD player analogy for solar panels on it, I should have actually said satellite dishes, and they would have all tied together neatly.
Yeah, we won't go back and re-record that bit, Phil. I think we'll carry on. But yes, a nice idea. I think it's a neat idea. I think they did well to do it. I mean, I can't remember how much energy. Yes, in fact, I've got it written down here. Solar plant comprises two satellite antennae with 307 solar panels on each one, and each dish generates approximately 110,000 kilowatt hours of energy annually. They've also got solar panels, I think, on the roof of the building. And that, if I remember rightly, and I'd have to...
Is the building, is that the data center?
Yes, the data center, yes. Should have pointed out, actually, that this is all to power a data centre, which, as we know, is a very energy-intensive thing. Yeah, I think that the other solar panels they've got on the roof of the building are actually generating more electricity, but they're obviously not as interesting as these ones. And the chief executive, a chap called John Harris, chief executive of Luke TDC. John Harris, I imagine he's not Swiss, but he might be, said that the design of the dishes, which allows them to be aligned both horizontally and vertically, proved ideal for solar panel installation, which rather goes against what the chap from CKW was saying. He says that by following the sun's path throughout the day, these dishes optimize solar radiation absorption. Having installed them, we get considerably more hours of electricity than conventional string systems, and power optimizers enhance electricity production further. So, yeah, from what they're saying, sounds like it's worked like a dream.
You wonder what other redundant structures could be repurposed in this way.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, I think it's the fact that these things can actually track the sun, which is a really neat bit.
Yeah.
Because, of course, solar arrays anywhere else, you just point them in the best direction, and that optimizes it. But they're obviously less efficient than ones which are pointing at the sun all the time. So,
why don't electric cars have solar panels on the roof?
Probably because the amount of electricity they would gather would be minimal. Especially if you're going through a tunnel.
But you don't do that very often.
No, probably, I don't know, maybe it might be enough to charge your phone, but I'm not sure it'd do much else.
It sounds like you're dissing the concept of solar all round then, so we shouldn't be...
Going back to the government's plan for the houses, I take your point that maybe they should be incentivising people rather than obliging them to take certain measures. But I think there's, at the moment, why not? If everybody were to put... I mean, if everybody building houses for the next 5 years were to put solar panels on them, I'm sure that solar panels wouldn't be obsolete before then. So I'm sure it would work.
That's what they said about satellite dishes, David.
Well, I think the problem is, and we have mentioned this before, and I mentioned it earlier, that one of the problems with this sort of proliferation of solar, not just solar, but all renewables, and specifically small solar, I keep saying solar when I just mean renewable generally, small renewable energy generators. So, you know, a windmill or a small wind turbine on a farm or something like that, which, you know, we see those quite a lot around where I live, and people with solar panels in their field or on their roof and stuff like that. You've got a reasonable amount of electricity being produced nationally, but it's spread all over the place. It's not being produced all in one spot, like a gas-fired power station or a nuclear power station or even a large wind farm. You know, it's coming from, you know, Mrs. Blogg's roof over there and Mr. Robert's roof over there, and it all has to be coordinated and fed into the grid. And in fact, the government has been talking about regional pricing for electricity, haven't they? I don't know if you've been following that story, that they say that, you know, the cost of, for example, a lot of these North Sea wind farms can come ashore in Scotland, and people in Scotland could get a lot of very cheap electricity. It'd be far more expensive to actually send that electricity down south to London, for example, where a lot of electricity is required, because, you know, the cost of transporting it, you've got to build the pylons or the underground cables or whatever it is. And so actually distributing, I always thought it was simply a matter of wherever you were, you just plugged into the grid and anybody could help themselves to that electricity. But it's not like that. You've got to actually take the electricity to where it's required. And you've got to balance it, of course, and that's another sort of juggling trick. So I think that's one of the obstacles to actually rolling out micro renewable electricity over a large area.
Hmm. Do we pay the same? Do I pay the same as you? You're in Devon and I'm in Kent. Do we pay the same for our water, or do our water companies can set separate bills, can't they?
I mean, obviously they can, I'm sure.
We pay different companies, but there's not a set rate per whatever it is, litre of water.
No, I don't think so. No.
So if we pay different amounts for our water, why shouldn't we pay different amounts for our electricity?
No, why not? There's something, in fact, there will be an article coming out in the magazine in a month or two's time, on the topic of microgrids, because, of course, we have the national grid where our electricity is circulated around the country. But there's this concept of microgrids, and there are a couple of places that they are ideal, apparently, for remote areas and areas which can't necessarily get enough electricity locally, well, from the national grid. Places like the Scilly Isles and the Orkney Islands both have microgrids on them. Then they can incorporate, they can either take electricity from the national grid when they need it, but they can supplement that with renewable energy or energy from any other source, but we're basically talking about renewable energy produced locally. So we're talking about solar, we're talking about wind power. And that means that at certain times they can be almost self-sufficient in electricity. And the idea is that if you could roll that out across the country in areas which are, you know, a little bit in the back of beyond, that would help to even out the load on the national grid.
Hmm, interesting. That's coming up in the magazine in the next issue, is it?
In the next issue, yes.
Which is That's July. Right.
Yeah.
Look forward to that. Next topic.
Right, okay. Next topic. Where are we at? Well, we're still, I suppose. Slightly, we're moving on to AI, which is obviously another technological
artificial area, intelligence.
Artificial intelligence.
What does it mean? What is artificial intelligence? I mean, isn't Google artificial intelligence? Isn't anything that's not come from the human brain but comes from a machine?
I don't know. it's very difficult. I'm not sure what intelligence is, full stop, actually, but. I think the artificial intelligence, it basically, if you look at something like ChatGPT, it basically just scours the internet in seconds and then takes what it thinks is the relevant information and serves it up on a plate for you.
I think the modern meaning of it is it's sort of the machine learning element. It's stuff that learns how to improve itself. Hence all this controversy about writers and musicians having to hand over their works to, or allow their works to be stolen by Zuckerberg and Musk and these sort of people, so that their AI learning machines can, you know, read the complete works of whoever it might be. Frederick Forsyth, I'll mention, he's just passed away this week, and they can reproduce, you know, cracking Dare the Jackal thrillers in the style of Freddie Forsyth for nothing.
Well, I think that the reason that AI is in the news in the construction industry at the moment is that the government, being very sort of, well, you said that the government is very slow about adopting technology and stuff like that. There, Mr. Starmer's really with it at the moment because he's been working along with Google. been working with Google to develop an AI model called Extract, is it? I can't remember what it's called now.
Is it Extract or is it Extract?
Extract. I think it's Extract. Because it sort of extracts, what does it do? It's described as an AI assistant for planning officers and local councils to digitize records. So it's extracting information from, basically from, written records.
It's digitizing it. It's making, just like in the newspapers, it's getting all these old planning records and all the paperwork that comes in. And I don't know if someone's pointing their phone at it, but it all gets all sort of glooped up and becomes a, not a PDF, I can't imagine, but it becomes a, you know, a digital document.
I mean, I don't know how it works. Do they just feed it into a sort of like a scanner or some sort of machine and it reads it and then produces a digital version of it? It's not clearly explained, but I mean, by some magic, basically, this is the message. They use some sort of magic to turn written documents into digital documents, and that presumably,
which can then be analysed and read. That's the important bit. It's not just so that you can carry it around on your phone or your laptop instead of in your briefcase with bunches of paper. It's that once all this data is in digital format, you can immediately see, you know, all the trends, exactly what's going on, where the hiccups are, what's going wrong, what the pinch points are, and all this sort of stuff.
Oh, so it actually analyzes it and gives you. No, I didn't realize that. I thought it was just producing a digital facsimile, which actually isn't all that impressive. We've been doing that for a long time. It says, according to the story that you wrote, Phil, that it can process about 100 planning records a day, which is quite impressive. I mean, the important thing about this, of course, is that one of the huge obstacles, one of the main obstacles to achieving Mr. Starmer's 1.5 million new homes built in this parliament is that the planning system itself is really slow and things get backed up and it holds everything up. So clearly, by getting Google on board and producing this AI model, they can speed things up massively. So, I mean, if it works, it would be great.
It does sound proper good, actually. And a couple of interesting different responses we got. The mentioned the National Federation of Builders before and the House Builders Association, its sister organisation. They're dead keen. They think this is great. They add to the fact that actually a lot of local authorities have been doing their own work in this sort of technology and doing some good stuff, you know, about automatically digitizing planning documents and so on. But the problem with that is each local authority is doing different things. Now, coming up with a a centralized solution. And again, you know, is the government the best person to pick the right solution? But hey, there's now one solution. And if all local authorities are using the same tool in the same way, that makes it an awful lot easier for people looking for planning permission or trying to access information about planning permission, because it'll all be on one dashboard. And you can find out all sorts of information that you might want to find out in one place. And so the builders go, yeah, we think it's fantastic, it's all great. Conversely, the Royal Town Planning Institute, which is the professional body of planners, rather than saying, this is fantastic, all the balls ache that our members have to go through is going to be made a lot easier, and they're going to have a really nice life, and they can just twiddle their thumbs while the machines do all the work. They kind of see, oh, all our members are going to be out of work.
Yes.
AI is going to take away the job of the local planning officers. So the RTPI people, they say, this is a, you know, it's a really good tool to help alleviate the pressure of a planner's day-to-day work, but they cannot replace planners' discretion and expertise and local knowledge and judgment in the decision-making process. You actually have to have one of our members, not a machine, to do this work. So don't sack our members is the message.
But I didn't think that was the case anyway. I thought it was only to sort of digitize existing documents. I mean, presumably it doesn't produce new documents and create new planning documents from scratch. Maybe it does.
But it's a bit like they're saying that for an awful lot of medical complaints, you know, Dr. Google is as good as your actual GP who you can't get an appointment with. And so there is a lot of movement in the medical world, or talk of going to, you know, AI diagnoses, and then you just go straight to, you know, the operating table where a robot will take out your kidneys or whatever you need to do to you. In the same way with this, if AI's got all the answers, maybe you don't need planning bureaucrats. Maybe you can just, you know, put your application into the machine. The computer says, yes, you can build that, because we are the builders, not the blockers. Maybe it'll just be machine driven.
Yeah, well,
it'd be a nightmare scenario, but some people might like it.
I mean, I suppose the typical sort of Luddite response is, well, how do you know that what this computer is doing, what this robot, this artificial intelligence is doing, is actually accurate or even correct in any way? I mean, for example, if it is converting old hand-drawn documents into digital data in minutes, what's it missing?
Rubbish in, rubbish out, is the old saying, isn't it?
Well, it could be. I don't know. I mean, presumably there must be some sort of internal mechanism to sort of check the accuracy and the reliability of the data it's generating. But I don't know. That would be my worry, that it's actually misinterpreting. If it's old hand-drawn documents, what if it can't read somebody's handwriting very well?
Well, I might be completely imagining this, or it might be in some film or TV program I saw, but I have something in my head about machines having trouble with italics, and italics completely stumped a machine. I might be making that up, but it goes to your point.
Yeah, interesting. Well, yeah, there we are. So you've got to do it in sort of Roman numerals.
Right, I can't think of anything else on that topic, because I'm, like you, I'm a bit in over my head when it comes to AI.
Yes, I'm afraid so.
I like it to make my life easier, but we don't want to take our jobs away. It's the end and the bottom line of all of that, isn't it? Mm,
indeed.
Anything else on your agenda?
That's about it. I don't think there's anything else we need to mention. Well, there is, as you say, as we speak, Rachel Reeves is delivering her spending review or whatever it is. So presumably we'll talk about that in a fortnight's time, in which case it will be old news, but we'll get the response from people in the industry, that's for sure.
I would just say, don't believe the hype, folks.
Hmm.
Beware of re-announcements. The one thing I wanted to give a passing mention to, which is quite jolly, we've talked before about the Building Safety Act and how buildings over 18 metres tall have to, or of 18 metres or more height, have to go to the new Building Safety Regulator,
yes,
the HSE, for their building control. Three-stage process. Show them your plans before, and then for application after before you start building, and then before anyone can move in. And there's been a lot of discussion. It's 80 metres in height or seven stories. So yeah. If it's less than 80 metres but it's seven stories, you don't have to go to the building safety regulator. Now, apparently there's been some chat about whether if you've got a flat roof and you know, tables and chairs, you've got a roof garden on the roof, is that an eighth floor or is that just a roof? If you're using it, is it a roof or is it a garden? Is it part of the building? And the government have clarified in saying, no, a roof garden is a roof. It's not a story. So that's...
And common sense prevails. That's unusual.
Basically, yes. Hurrah.
Jolly good. So you can go ahead and put that garden on your roof, Phil.
Well, it'd be angled. I said, no, I do have a tiny bit of flat roof, but no, I don't think I'll be doing that.
Right. All right.
Next time, see you in, be back end of June. Be proper summer by then, all being well.
Yeah, yes, indeed.
Okay, well, thank you for listening, everyone, once again. I've been Phil Bishop. He's been David Taylor. This has been Reconstruction. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.